This morning, our speaker is Shelley McCormick. Shelley is a software test engineer with Tractor Supply Company and an agnostic atheist Christian. Shelley grew up in the Presbyterian Church and in an exploration of belief systems after a long religious hiatus, she found the Unitarian Universalism and joined the UU Fellowship of Sonoma County in 2002. She moved to Middle Tennessee from the San Francisco Bay Area with her husband, John, 10 years ago. Shelley will speak on the topic, What Not to Wear, Cultural Appreciation or Appropriation. Let's welcome Shelley.
Good morning, everyone. So those of you who came today to hear Rabbi Rami, I'm sorry. He had a conflict, and I was going to be speaking next week, so Jill asked me if I'd just swap with him. And I kind of am sorry about that, because my credentials are nowhere near as impressive as his are. I'm not an expert on world religions. I'm not an expert on cultural traditions, not even my own culture. As a white American of almost exclusively British and German heritage, I'm hard-pressed to think of an ethnic group my folks haven't oppressed or marginalized or exploited in some way. So I really don't know that I'm qualified to talk about cultural appropriation, but I hope to give you at least something to think about. So the idea, and I say so a lot, don't I? I just realized that. So the idea for this talk came to me as we were getting close to Halloween, and Facebook had, there was a Facebook app that would overlay your photo with a Day of the Dead, a sugar skull, and I saw some of my friends did that, and it looked cool. I mean, it just did. I started seeing, you know, costume shops were advertising their sexy fill-in-the-blank costumes, and top sellers were sexy Princess Leia, Dallas Cowboys cheerleader. But there were also the sexy gypsy, the sexy Native American, and the sexy Day of the Dead señorita. And coming from that German background, I have to say, Heidi Ho irritated me just a little bit. So that whole thing got me started thinking about things I've done for Halloween, costumes I've chosen, some of the choices I made back in my younger days. I look back and I think, ooh, that probably really wasn't okay. There was no harm intended, but maybe that just wasn't quite okay. So I'm going to kind of go into some of the definitions of cultural appropriation. We hear that a lot. We've heard it a lot since around the 80s, I think, when it really started to get some scholarship around it. And I couldn't find a single definition that pulled it all together for me, so I have a few. From the Huffington Post, cultural appropriation is the practice of borrowing traditional artifacts, customs, rituals, or dress from another culture, often done without regard for the significance of such articles in their society of origin. It's often performed by members of first world countries who consider the icons of third world nations to be exotic or edgy. And if you by borrow you mean steal, then that's pretty good. Appropriation is actually taking something, usually without permission. It's not borrowing, it's not an exchange. Another element is the objectification and commercialization of someone else's culture, usually somebody whose the dominant culture is commercializing the marginalized culture. There's a site on Tumblr, This Is Not China, kind of helped fill in that gap, pointing out that it's not merely the act of wearing or partaking in cultural symbols and practices that do not belong to you. It's a system of exploitation and capitalization on cultural symbols and practices that do not A, originate from, B, benefit, or C, circle back to the culture in question. And then lastly on My Culture Is Not a Trend on Tumblr, hipsters wearing headdresses is cultural appropriation because it because it is a commodification of indigenous culture. It takes something from someone else's culture without any context or respect and turns it into something marketable and profitable, but again, not from the culture it came from. Keep a little track of time here. And then everydayfeminism.com gets to the heart of it. A deeper understanding of cultural appropriation also refers to a particular power dynamic in which members of a dominant culture take elements from a culture of people who have been systemically oppressed by that dominant group. So cultural appropriation shouldn't be confused with assimilation, which is what happens kind of in reverse, the other way. It's when the oppressed or marginalized people adopt the dominant culture's expression in order to survive conditions that make life more of a struggle if they don't. In many cases, colonized countries were forced to adopt the culture of the colonizer, while their own culture is violently removed. And in the case, specifically one of the cases in Hawaii, violently removed and then brought back and sold, made in China. I believe that there is a strain of cultural appropriation that's really a backhanded way of forcing assimilation by commercializing something sacred to the marginalized or to the not the dominant group, turning it into a mainstream mass marketed accessory that you can buy at your local Walmart. Nor should it be conflated with cultural exchange, which has at its heart respect for the authentic traditions and expressions of another culture and isn't rooted in the imbalance of power. Again, Ms. Magazine, and when I do these talks, you know, sometimes I talk my own thoughts, sometimes I just quote other people, so it all kind of fits together somehow. So I'm going to quote MsMagazine.com. Appreciation is knowing the historical and political significance of what you're trying to wear before getting dressed, versus throwing on a Dreamcatcher t-shirt from Urban Outfitters and calling it a day. If you only care for sugar skulls or geishas on October 31st, you clearly don't care for Mexican or Japanese culture. You may think these costumes have harmless intentions, but by wearing cultures as costumes on Halloween, you're trivialized the struggles minorities deal with every single day. You can't accept the aesthetics of a culture without acknowledging these groups are alienated because they are different. So I have a few examples to think about. I'm not going to talk about the appropriation of black music and culture by white performers in the entertainment industry. That would be a whole series of talks unto itself. And it's something I encourage people, especially in the music industry, to pay a little attention to. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying it's wrong to participate in and appreciate the traditions of a culture you don't belong to, or to even use a Facebook Sugar Skull app, when you understand and embrace who and what it stands for. So with that said, let's talk about the Day of the Dead. It's a Mexican holiday. Holidays are ripe for appropriation. We all know that. Halloween, especially, the solstice and the equinox celebrations appropriated and celebrated in different ways all around the world. So the Day of the Dead started out as an Aztec celebration of the dead, and it was in the summertime. Started thousands of years before Mexico existed as a country. It was originally celebrated in the summer, until the Spanish Catholic priests appropriated and conflated it with All Saints Day and All Souls Day to transform it into an acceptable Christian holiday. Halloween itself has a rich history as an indigenous European holiday that celebrated many of the same themes as Day of the Dead and was also appropriated by the church, the Christian church, and rolled into All Saints Day. According to Catholic.org, the choice of the day may have been intended to co-opt the pagan holiday. Surprise. I read a lot. I Googled. I read a lot of blogs. I read a lot of posts by people of Mexican heritage about how they felt about the, you know, Day of the Dead Senorita as a Halloween costume and that kind of thing. And from This Is Not Our DIA at Tumblr, when white people use a sacred tradition that historically was suppressed by whites simply as an excuse to throw a party, it's disrespectful. Do not insist upon inserting yourself in a sacred holiday simply to further your own status or self-image. Do not trivialize Dia de los Muertos by reducing it to simple face paint. Do not perpetuate stereotypes and one-dimensional images of a rich and varied tradition. But one commenter also wrote, if a person, no matter what race they are, understands and believes this in this holiday and feels in their heart the need to celebrate it, then they should. However, I'll reiterate, it's unacceptable and inappropriate for anyone to use it as a Halloween costume or otherwise if they have no idea what it truly stands for. And Halloween itself, this is something that you know when you hear it, but I didn't really ever think of it before. There is a scholar, Professor Susan Scafida, I don't know how to pronounce her name, at Fordham University, and she's published some books on cultural issues. And she says, Halloween is a holiday, has a history of being focused on inversion of power. It's about turning the daily world on its head. People dress up as celebrities, cops, politicians, and other powerful figures. And it's funny. But when you dress up as a culture that you're currently oppressing or have subjugated in the past, you're not inverting anything. You're just reinforcing current power structures in an offensive way. So I'm going to move on to another culture, again, I have a lot of cultural guilt around this because my forebears were here doing this to people. This is on the topic of Native American appropriations. There was at Bonnaroo about 5 years ago a group called Neon Indians. Their name had nothing to do with their shows, their performance, and this isn't specifically about them. This is about a group of fans, teenage girls, who showed up while they were playing and jumped on stage wearing headdresses, painted on stuff, and not much else. Adrian Kay wrote, Native women, about this event and about the idea of the sexy Indian costumes in general, Native women have been highly sexualized throughout history and in pop culture, were either sexy squaws, the most offensive term out there, wise grandmas, or overweight ogres. But the pervasive sexy squaw is the most dangerous, especially when you know the basic facts around sexual violence against Native women. And she says, 1 in 3 Native women will be raped in their lifetime. 70% of sexual violence against Native women is committed by non-natives. This is not just about cultural appropriation. This is about a serious, scary, and continuing legacy of violence against women in Indian country. These girls probably thought they were just being counterculture or edgy, but by perpetuating the stereotypes of Native women as sexual objects, they're aiding and continuing in the cycle of violence. As I was reviewing my notes yesterday for this talk, I remembered who I was talking to and thought, I better check those facts. So I went to the Amnesty International USA site, and it's worse. Native American and Alaska Native women are more than 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted than other women in the U.S. And according to the U.S. Department of Justice, at least 86% of the reported cases of rape or sexual assault against American Indian and Alaska Native women survivors report that perpetrators are non-Native men. Historically, Indigenous women were raped by settlers and soldiers, including the Trail of Tears and the Long Walk. Such attacks were not random or individual. They were tools of conquest and colonization. This puts the bycostumes.com Pocahontas costume on a whole nother plane of existence. Heidi Ho doesn't seem quite so bad now. But I said almost exclusively British and German is my heritage. There was an Indian way back, and I think for anyone who's been in this country, whose family came to this country more than a couple hundred years ago, that's probably true. But so why wouldn't I claim that heritage and wear a Dreamcatcher t-shirt or some other sacred Indian object? It's statistically unlikely, in my opinion, that the product of that relationship was a relationship of star-crossed lovers. It wasn't a Romeo and Juliet. And knowing that in myself, that part of my heritage came from, most likely, almost certainly in my opinion, such a violent act, does not fill me with pride. It fills me with horror, really. And it's hard to get past that, to take pride in a culture that I know nothing about anyways. Adrian Kay, who wrote about the Neon Indian fans, also wrote that heritage is not a get-out-of-jail-free card that can be used to excuse racism or as a convenient way to dismiss or win an argument. So, move on from one group of indigenous people to another. Aloha! I play the ukulele. And the costume choice I referred to that I look back now and kind of regret did involve a grass skirt and a plastic leg. I never really thought about it. I just, you know, it was a costume and it was Halloween and it just didn't occur to me that might be painful. And in the group I was in, I'm pretty sure there were no Native Hawaiians to cause pain. Nevertheless, I look back and think, wow, that might have been not a great choice. As I was preparing for this talk, I came across an interview Owen Lloyd did, who probably you might never have heard of. I'll remember him. He interviewed Anne Keala Kelly on the Deep Green Resistance News Service about appropriation of Hawaiian artifacts and rituals. What happened was, as he says, recently the school where my wife works decided to host luau events throughout the state I live. When she, my wife, contacted the school to tell them the events were cultural appropriation and racist, they quickly responded by transforming the event into a beach party. Calling out racism in this way can be both challenging and courageous, especially when there are so few resources available, either to educate people about the luau or to support the voices of those who call out the appropriation of Hawaiian culture. In order to make such a resource available, I contacted my Native Hawaiian friend, Anne Keala Kelly, and asked her some questions about the appropriation of her culture. It was a very long interview, and I wish I could read you the whole thing. It was extremely eye-opening for me. But I'm going to just read a few excerpts from it, and then I'll tell you why I'm doing this at a UU congregation. So, traditional luau, before the U.S. overthrow and occupation of Hawaii, had Hawaiian food like poi and kalo and or taro dishes, coconut dishes, fish, and pork. Depending on who it was for, it could be a large all-day affair. It could take hours to get through the meal. It was never a tourist attraction because it was not an industry. And I doubt any Hawaiians from pre-overthrow Hawaii would have imagined it becoming such a bastardized, commodified event that people the world over used to cannibalize Hawaiian culture. In the early part of the 20th century, as tourism started to become normalized in Hawaii, the lei wasn't so much appropriated from a traditional Hawaiian use of it as it was overtly commodified and turned into a mechanized thing. Even though real people make them, it's mostly about money now. I think the first years after the U.S. takeover, Hawaiians must have felt like ghosts in their own land, because even after the Christianization of Hawaiians and Europeanization of the government, after 90% of the entire population died over such a short time, Heole people still hated us. They still hated our aloha. Reducing us to a lei-making and giving people is a hatred for the spiritual and philosophical bones of us. It's also a reminder to the native that no matter how assimilated you do or don't become, you are not respected by the dominant settler society. I could go on. Actually, and on, and I'm running a little shorter on time than I thought, so I'm going to leave out some of the other things she said. If you're interested, Google Anne Kalea, that's K-E-A-L-A, and her last name is Kelly, like K-E-L-L-Y. I'm going to read one last thing from her. If it stopped at the occasional frat party, I'd say not much in the way of political or social ramifications, but it's a nasty American pastime to ridicule Hawaiian culture. Making a mockery of us and our beautiful tradition of generosity and love undermines our sense of worth as a people. And her advice for non-Hawaiians wishing to stand with the Native Hawaiians against appropriation and colonialism, she said, and this set me back a little bit, for Americans it's a tough statement because they're comfortable lumping us with what was done to the natives on the continent. They're okay with the narrative of us as a tragic and past. They can talk about the occupation of Palestine, but Hawaii, that implies present tense possibility. My advice is to stand in solidarity with us, to understand what is actually happening to us now. So, I'm going to leave those examples, talk about why it's wrong, and then tell you why I'm talking about this today. Going back to quoting online sources, everydayfeminism.com, why cultural appropriation is wrong. It trivializes violent historical oppression. It lets people show love for the culture but remain prejudiced against its people. We live in a world in which racist white people can essentially say, we want your stuff, but we don't like you. Or as actress Amanda Stenberg asked, what would America be like if we loved black people as much as we love black culture? Number three, it makes things cool for white people, but too ethnic for people of color. Number four, it lets privileged people profit from oppressed people's labor. When white women dominate and profit from the industry of New Age materials with watered-down versions of Indian spirituality practices, the Native women she adopted her products from live in deep cycles of poverty and unemployment. So now, why am I talking to you about this? We're like the poster children for civil rights and for social justice. We're on the front lines there. Why I'm talking about this is because of largely what's in this book. At the front of the book, you'll find the six sources of our living tradition, and particularly the third one of our sources is wisdom from the world's religions, which inspires us in our ethical and spiritual life. And the sixth, which was added, I think, in 1995, spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. So because of what else is in this book, which are songs from many, many, many traditions, many, many world religions, all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of cultural traditions and religious traditions. Because we read stories of Anansi and Diwali, and because we, just a few weeks ago, we sang O Come Emmanuel in the same service as the solstice tribute. That's what I love about this congregation and this faith, this religious community. But it also can set us up for inadvertent insensitivity when we're choosing the things to embrace and the things to explore and the things to bring into this this spiritual journey. UUA, which has a lot of resources on multicultural issues, says our holiday services use the stories and traditions creatively, calling us to our deeper humanity and our commitment to the good. And that's all wonderful. And because we have only the best of intentions and the most loving of intentions. That's why I wanted to bring some of these examples here to say, in spite of our best intentions, sometimes we do things like, this is me personally, wear a grass skirt, you know, a fake paper skirt and a plastic leg, not realizing that it could be something that brings pain to another person. Also, because we're a little bit unusual. We are a religious community, a community of faith, differing faiths or no faith. Nevertheless, we're a community that fills that need in us. Yet we don't have in our present-day practices any long-standing spiritual traditions. Our flower communion, that was less than 100 years ago. We know who created it, when, where, why. Chalukya, just the last not even 10 years, I don't think, 2006, that was started to come into our tradition. But I left a religion that has traditions and has songs and has prayers that go back for hundreds or thousands of years. And I think many of us did. I know a lot of us didn't, but because I have that background, or maybe because it's just hardwired in our brains, I feel drawn to traditions that extend back for centuries or millennia. Whether I understand those traditions or not, I want to explore them and share them. But looking at this helps me to do that in a more respectful and more sensitive way. As I mentioned, there are a lot of resources on UUA.org talking about worship and cultural misappropriation. And I'm going to read from a little bit from that now. There's actually an article called When Worship Becomes Cultural Misappropriation. Donald Skinner wrote it. And he said, as Unitarian Universalists, we take pride in being open to many religious traditions and cultures, and we often draw from them in our own worship. But when we do, it's important that we be aware of how we're using those words and symbols of other cultures. We talk about needing to become more multicultural if we want to attract people who are different from us. At the same time, we have to have some understanding of what has value in different communities. And lastly, Reverend Danielle DeBona, she's the president of Diverse and Revolutionary Unitarian Universalist Multicultural Ministries. She spoke at the General Assembly in 2001, encouraging us to make a distinction between education and misappropriation, the difference between teaching children about a culture by making dream catchers or masks, and using part of a culture's religious practices in our own worship services. When you pick and choose from these things, it trivializes their spiritual practices. If it's not in context, if the user is not walking with us, if the user is not part of our struggle, then it is presumptuous. Last night, again, as I was kind of trying to fill in some gaps and trying to pare this down to fit within 20 minutes, and I'm sorry I did not succeed in that as well as I had thought, I came across something else that Reverend DeBona was involved in. And when I came across this and read it, I sat in my chair. I sat back. I literally, physically sat back in my chair and said, wow. She was part of the Council for Cross-Cultural Engagement, which first convened about cultural misappropriation, which occurred at the General Assembly in 2007 in Seattle. And that council spoke at the 2009 GA about how an individual may feel marginalized when music, poem, reading, prayer, or spiritual practice is used without context, credit, or any sense of relationship to the communities involved. Now, when I was looking at music for January, those who don't know, I work on picking out music for services. Rabbi Rami was supposed to speak today, and those were his songs. Okay, those were what I picked to go along with his talk, even though I have no idea what he's talking about. My songs were supposed to be Ours a Religion and Love Will Guide Us. Okay, well, when I read about Reverend DeBona's experience and success in Seattle, her description of that, she had attended the service of the Living Tradition, and the program included We'll Build a Land, which is number 121, which we just sang. And when she, a Wampanoag Indian, saw hundreds of mostly white faces in the hall singing this, she thought how white European culture indeed had built on Native American land. Knowing all this was done at the expense of Native culture caused her great pain. And as I was singing that this morning, that was heavily on my mind. She shared those feelings with Keith Arnold, president of UU Musicians Network, who had planned the service. His initial response was he'd never sing the song again, and that's kind of what I'm feeling like right now. But she answered that he could, now that she had been heard. As she said, he advises, in that situation, answering with, tell me more, rather than trying to explain what you hoped a song would mean. And as she said, it can take courage for someone, especially a person of color, to confront misappropriation in a worship service or elsewhere. If I do that, she said, what I don't want is to be told that I misunderstood what I experienced or that it was done as a way of honoring my tradition. That defeats the conversation. What is helpful is to have a conversation. So, what I'm going to leave you with is that I know we do our best to be sensitive, to be welcoming, to embrace. We just need to make an effort to be aware. And if we do get called on it, if someone does raise the question of, is this really appreciation? Is this really a cultural exchange? Or is this appropriation? We need to listen with open hearts. If someone points out that in our limited, in my case, you know, my limited experience with other cultures and other religions, if someone points out to me that I am going down a path in that direction, then I need to listen with an open heart and an open mind and thank them for showing me, for illuminating that for me. And that concludes this talk. Like Kitty said, that may have been a weak ending, but there it is.